Hello, and welcome to the Global Film Podcast, a weekly discussion of all things cinema. I'm your host, Diego Andaluz, and today I'm happy to be joined by Jeffrey Zhang, editor-in-chief and host of Strange Harbors.
Hey, Diego, nice to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Tessa Smith, editor-in-chief of Mama's Geeky.
Hi, Diego. Thanks for inviting me here today.
And Valerie Complex, film critic who's written for Variety, Den of Geek, The Playlist, Consequence of Sound, and more.
Thanks for having me back again.
Yeah, it's so great to have all of you guys on here. So on today's episode, we'll be discussing the recent edition of the Sundance 2021 Film Festival. So what we'll be doing on this episode is kind of going through each of the competition categories, as well as Next, Midnight, Premieres, and other sections, and kind of just discussing our overall opinions on all of the films that we've seen or haven't seen in competition. So let's delve right into the U.S. Dramatic Competition. So again, this was a section with about 10 films. The first opener of the festival was actually called Coda, and I'm sure it was a big hit. Pretty much everyone saw it, so I'm also interested to hear what you guys thought on it.
And Coda was cool. It was pretty formulaic, but it had some really nice moments. I had one moment that made me tear up. I know a lot of people loved it, but I thought it was kind of middle of the road, family drama. I'm surprised Disney didn't buy it because it belongs on that channel.
It hit a lot of familiar beats. I think they played really into the conventions of the genre, like the coming of age, you know, with those comedies, like heartfelt drama. Nothing that you've never seen before, but I did like that they played a little twist with just having a hearing girl and her deaf family. I thought that brought a lot of freshness to it, but yeah, it was a crowd pleaser, and I'm not surprised that it won the big prize here, because I think it's the most accessible out of all of these.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, agree. No, I think I think you're right. I think it was an accessible film, and I thought it was good for representation for the deaf community.
Yeah, I mean, they had real life deaf actors, so that was fantastic.
Oh no, it's just funny. I was gonna say I thought the same exact thing about Disney. And actually, my friend that works at Disney, after I saw it, I messaged him and said, "Oh, I feel like there's gonna be a new movie," and then Apple picked it up. But I did enjoy it overall, and I thought it was fun. I almost skipped it the first night. There was just so much going on, and I'm glad I sat down to watch it. I almost skipped it, and I thought, "All right, I'll sit down." And I'm glad I did. It was funnier than I thought it was going to be.
It was.
Yeah. I was just saying that I found it to be actually really good for, as Valerie was saying, deaf and just overall disabled representation. Because a lot of times when stories focus on characters like those, they focus on their hardships, what they need to overcome in the world. But this just treats them as like normal, everyday characters who can laugh, who can cry, who like their main focus of their lives is not their disability. Yes, it is a part of their identity, but it's not kind of like what defines them. And they have lives outside of their disability. So that's something I really appreciate. However, I do think that it was a little bit conventional and it's coming of age tropes. That's something that I think everyone has said here today. Some of the high school beats were a little bit too like predictable and stuff, but overall I found it to be very funny, heartfelt. And again, I was really close to skipping it, but then I was like, you know what? No, opening night, I better check it out. And I'm so glad that it sold to Apple. It apparently broke all the acquisition records. And who knows when it's going to be out, but it seems to be quite the crowd pleaser.
I think it was kind of an asshole move for Apple to buy it for that much money. Because pretty much what's happening is it drives up sort of the supply, demand for things. So now that people see that, okay, well, this sort of, you know, run-of-the-mill film got $25 million, I should be able to get this for my film. And I know like a lot of people are delusional in thinking that, but it's what happens. And that could be why things are not flying off the shelf as quickly as they were the last 2 years. Because when I went in 2018, like every day something was being bought, like just every day something was being bought. But now it's like, you know, I can see, okay, Coda got picked up. And then there's another one we're going to talk about that got picked up. But then like, I found Summer of Soul being picked up last was weird. I don't know. Anyway, I just want to throw that out.
Valerie, I agree. I think especially in this year when not that many films are being snatched up like previous years, it's even more jarring, right? Because you have like a record setting acquisition and then like crickets everywhere else. And it's a little odd. I totally agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I thought it was going to go to Amazon. And then when it got to Apple at that price tag, again, like I was at first, I think most people were like optimistic that like, okay, this is going to like signal that like this is going to be a huge market, acquisitions every day. But I don't know if it's might because of the pandemic, because again, it was mainly the streaming services who showed up, or companies who have partnered with streaming services in the past, like Searchlight or Neon. I think Magnolia was the only one who like is an only theatrical distributor who picked up something at the fest. So it might also be a case of that. But overall, I do have to admit it was a pretty weak year for acquisitions.
It's for sure pandemic related, right? It's for sure pandemic. Yeah,
100%.
So we'll see where it goes from here.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, so John and the Hole, pretty divisive. I believe all of us except for Valerie have seen this one. So what are your guys' thoughts on this one?
It wasn't what I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be more like horror and not this annoying little brat kid who thinks he... I don't know. It just wasn't what I expected. It wasn't bad. It was a meh for me, but it was one of my most anticipated movies. And so it kind of fell flat on that aspect. I felt like it didn't know if it was a dark comedy or a horror and that's kind of, I kind of left it going, I don't really know what genre this was, but it was an okay movie.
Yeah. John was the most annoying part of John in the Hole. I didn't really like this one. I thought it was very trying hard to be, I don't know, like a Lanthimos film. And it kind of felt like a pale imitation. And I just didn't like it. Like Tessa said, it didn't know what it wanted to be. It wasn't a dark comedy. It wasn't really horror. I thought the main performance was pretty weak. I thought the supporting cast was pretty good, but it spent way too much with John, and I thought his performance was a little... And let's not even get started with like the logical holes in this movie. There's so many like inconsistencies and things that don't make any sense, which is fine for like an art house like horror film, but like this was not that, so I wasn't crazy about this one.
Well, I think it was definitely trying to be that art house horror film. Like, pretty much everyone who I talked to thought, like, okay, before they had seen it, like, this is going to be an easy A24 acquisition. It seems right up their vein. And even when I turned it on, when you see that aspect ratio, and you see kind of like the way it's shot, you're like, okay, this is definitely going to go to A24 or some indie distributor like that. And like for the first, I'd say like half of the film, it's very, very engaging. It seems like it's going somewhere. And then the last half, it really just like prioritizes style over substance, which it personally worked for me because I think this is a debut director and he does a wonderful job. I think he like actually is a visual artist and this is like he decided to try film. And as a director, he does a wonderful job. But the screenplay, it just ends in such a pointless way that it kind of comes off as a dark comedy. But with all the setups that were happening, it just does not work. And it's just a total letdown. And the ambiguous ending, I don't know. What do you guys think about that part of it?
There's a couple movies that just end like that that drove me crazy during this festival. But this one, yeah, I don't know. I liked the first half. And then after that, I just didn't seem to care anymore. Like we said, John was like super annoying. And then the way it ended was just like, really? Like, I don't want to give stuff away. That's why I'm trying to not give spoilers. But like as a parent... Yeah. That's not how John would have been. I'm just saying. And that drove me crazy because I'm watching this going, there's no way my kid would have been, I don't want to give spoilers, but you know what, you guys know what I'm talking about because you've seen it. Yeah. There's no way that would have been.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
This kid would have been in serious trouble. Yeah, no,
it was
trouble.
A little bit unbelievable. But another one that we kind of, I believe, all watched, was Passing. And I know we were in this chat and like at first everyone was like, oh, wow, it's actually done quite well. And then came the Q&A, which I know kind of like turned a lot of people off from the film because apparently some of the director's comments seemed very insensitive or naive. So I'm also curious to hear what you guys thought of the film as a standalone product and then as well with like Rebecca Hall's comments.
I did not watch the Q&A because directors tend to always ruin the experience for me. So I really try to I'm just not interested in hearing what they have to say. So I skipped the Q&A, so I feel better. As a movie, you know, I think Rebecca Hall is a great director. I think she has a very good eye. Her cinematographer, Eduardo Grau, I think that's his name or whatever. They really work well together. I think she has a great vision. even down to minute details like music and set design. Like, I think all of that is just wonderful. I think that the story for her was a tall order. It's too vague.
Yeah, I think in our chat, I was asking, like, was this really her story to tell? And you said not really, mm-hmm. right? I think Valerie, yeah, that's what you said, right?
It was not. You know, she, Rebecca Hall, had a racial breakthrough finding out about her mom or whatever, about a year or two ago, that her mom was like half Black or whatever. So the film comes from a very personal place, and you can see that. And it really kind of, I think, it reflects the lack of knowledge that she has about what it means to be passing. So, yeah, I just don't think, I wonder what it would have been like if a Black woman had written it and she directed it. It could have been a really nice sort of symbiotic relationship between two women artists working together. So that's my thoughts on that.
I skipped the Q&A on this one, too. On most of them, I did. I love Tessa Thompson of Ruth Negga. So I was like ridiculously excited for this movie. Again, it was one of my most anticipated. And I enjoyed it enough, but I did feel it was lacking something, and some parts were almost confusing. Like, you couldn't, I didn't love their relationship together. I loved their chemistry on screen, but their actual relationship felt like I wasn't sure where it was at certain times. But overall, I did like it. And I feel like the ending, I'm still not 100% sure what happened at the end there. And I keep thinking about it. And I watched the ending the last few minutes a few times over just to see if I could, if there was any exact clarity.
Going into the film, I actually expected it to be like a more like Oscar Beatty-ish drama, just going for that awards play like later in the season and just not taking many risks. But Rebecca Hall impressed me by just how much she does in the framing, in the lighting, in the shot composition, even like the way that she chose to frame it or like position it as a Hitchcockian thriller was really intriguing to me. And so like that angle really like made me, okay, like Rebecca Hall, I think she's definitely a director to watch who is going to do great things in the coming years. But the ending, I just felt as if so many pieces were starting to come together, and then the ending just cut it all off and just made all those pieces pointless. Because I feel like if that had been maybe the midpoint of the film, or like the start of the third act, a lot of things could have been revealed, because there were definitely a lot of things that were like left unspoken. And sometimes that works in films, but for this film, I think it kind of went to its detriment, because it just really like, it left a lot of this, its themes hanging, and you're not quite sure what it's trying to say, in my opinion.
I agree. And I think this goes back to what you're saying, Tessa. Like, I think an ending like that deserves the clarity of editing, and that ending was not edited very well. I just, like, if you have to rewind, I mean, you don't have that. Like, we're lucky because we're in the virtual festival that you can rewind. But like in the theater, you don't have that option, right? And the fact that I had to rewind like twice to see like what happened in the end, it was a little jarring, and like I was a little confused. But yeah, gorgeous film though.
Yeah, it was gorgeous. And I think it should have been shot in black and white, and I'm glad they did that. I think it made it better.
Yeah.
The ending is like by design. It's ambiguous in the book, and I think it's supposed to be left up to interpretation. Which is why the ending probably is really confusing, is because the rest of it never came together. You never really got the answers you were looking for. Like, okay, so is this a queer couple, or what are they doing? Is she mad at, you know, is Irene mad at Claire because she's trying to infringe on her personal space and she's passing for white? Or like, it just, there was a lot going on, and you know, you had to interpret like faces and movements. It was too much guesswork. I thought that it was just, I like to work, but damn, I don't like to work all that much. And it was just a lot of brain power. But I do love the performances. I thought Ruth Negga kind of just bulldozed her way through each scene, and she was kind of like irresistible to watch. I really hope that she sort of rides that one out to an award of some sort, because I don't see anybody topping that performance as a supporting role. Somebody will really have to come out the gate swinging, because I don't see anybody doing better.
I mean, honestly, I feel it is a little bit early to predict stuff. I'd say like locks in the season, although there is one that we'll discuss later on that I'm pretty confident will. But I think that it's definitely going to be an awards player now that Netflix kind of acquired it. I was surprised that like no one had acquired it until I think it was yesterday or the day before yesterday. But now that Netflix kind of made a move for that, I could definitely see it playing the long-term game and hopefully nabbing up some awards. But another film that I think I was the only one who saw, so I'll just cover it real quick, is Superior. This was one of my most anticipated films of the festival. And I'll tell you this, the first opening 10 minutes and the last ending 10 minutes played like a giallo version of Twin Peaks, and I was like absolutely digging it. But the middle hour is just so empty and like barely anything happens that it completely ruins the momentum of the film. And I'd say honestly the worst film I saw at the festival, unfortunately. But one that most of us saw, I believe, was also On the Count of Three.
I liked On the Count of Three. I think having a movie revolve around a suicide pact is a very, very tricky needle to thread. Like, I don't know how you make that satisfying. Like, one way it's manipulative, the other way it's depressing. So I don't know, like, how you balance that. And I don't think it quite pulled it off. But this movie was a lot funnier than I expected it to be. I think both the lead actors were great. Some great needle drops in this one. I love the soundtrack on this. Some Papa Roach action in this. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought I was like halfway through the film, but I think the ending leaves a little bit to be desired. I don't think it nails it, but I don't know. Tessa, what did you think?
Yeah, this is one I had missed at first, and then I watched it the final day, which because everyone was saying so many good things about it, and I'm really glad that I did. You're right. I mean, first of all, soundtrack amazing. I literally was singing along to several moments of this, and I didn't even care. I was at the top of my lungs in my office singing the words. But yeah, it's a very touchy subject. It's very bold for that to be a choice of literally the whole movie is we're going to kill ourselves when this is over. But I did enjoy it. It's definitely funnier than I expected with being such a heavy subject. I wasn't expecting all the humor. But you're right, the ending left a little to be desired. It was not what I was anticipating, and it was depressing, honestly. I was like, oh, yeah. I kind of enjoyed this whole movie, and now I'm depressed. This is fantastic. So, but I mean, overall, it was a decent film.
Yeah, like honestly, it was another one where I actually picked In the Earth, which we'll talk about in a second, over this one for the actual screening. But luckily, I was able to kind of just like finish In the Earth pretty quickly and then just go right into On the Count of Three, which is something I did a lot and it worked actually quite well. But this one, again, I don't think I fell in love with it as much as most other people did, but it did have a very, very strong script, which it ended up winning for. And the performances were great. Jared Carmichael, again, I've heard of him. I had never actually seen his previous work. I think he's mostly a stand-up comedian, but he does some great stuff in the direction department. And overall, I think it's, again, it's one of those films that is able to kind of like balance all these tones in a very well put way. So I do have to commend that. I'd say kind of similar to kind of Palm Springs, I'd say last year at Sundance, that it has all these different tones and themes that it's trying to reach at. And while it may not go 100%, it still is able to balance all those themes without it seeming kind of insensitive or hurtful or too funny or too serious, but it's able to kind of like blend them all together, which is something I really appreciated. And then now, I guess, let's move on to another film that the three of us have seen, which is Mayday. Again, this one, it's very ambitious, I'd say, to say the least. It may have not fully worked for me, but I do want to hear what you guys thought about it.
I didn't love this one. I thought I would. On paper, it looks great. It sounds great. It sounds like it's going to be interesting. And I really like war movies, so I was excited with the war aspect of it. But I wasn't a giant fan of the fact, and I've been struggling so hard with how to word this correctly. But the fact that they're just luring men to their death for fun? I wasn't really, or maybe I didn't understand it right. I don't know, but I get that, like, there's men who have done bad. They felt like sirens to me, you know, like, oh, let's play damsel in distress. They love that. And this guy's talking about his wife and we're just going to kill him. I just didn't love that message and it didn't sit well with me. And so from that moment on, I was totally checked out. I watched it, but I was already mad at the movie. And so it didn't work well for me.
What movie is this again?
Mayday.
Mayday.
Yeah, I'm going to have to echo Tessa's sentiments here. Probably one of the biggest duds of this festival for me. I know a lot of people love this film and I just can't see it. I don't know why. It's just so narratively inert. And like, I was not invested in this storyline at all. First of all, it's like a fantasy where it's, you don't even know if things are real, and that already, I'm not crazy about that kind of storytelling, just because it's been done so many times. And well, still better than Zack Snyder's Sucker Punch, I'll tell you that. But this was very meandering, and I just couldn't connect with it at all. I really couldn't connect with this one. I think Mia Goth has like a very commanding presence, and maybe that's all the movie has going for it. Like, the visuals are pretty, gorgeous cinematography, but I think the feminist slant of this movie is very undercooked. And I just couldn't connect with it.
Yeah, again, I felt that the story, again, as you guys were saying, was a little bit wonky, a little bit like, I don't know exactly what it was trying to get at, because it wasn't as clear in its themes. The thing I did appreciate, which made it work for me, was the craftsmanship. I thought the direction was great. The cinematography was beautiful. Especially those nighttime shots in the car, that kind of sequence where it's a dream sequence, you're not quite sure what's going on. I loved that sequence. It kind of like brought it up a little bit for me. But just moving on to the rest of the dramatic competition, another one that I saw, and I believe I was the only one who saw, which kind of played on that dreamlike quality, was I Was a Simple Man, which I know it didn't work for a lot of people, but I really appreciated its mix of Uncle Boonmi meets the Tree of Life towards the end. So again, that was one that I think it's very unique, not going to work for many people, but for those that appreciate it, they're going to love it. And then the other one that I believe only Tessa and I have seen is Jockey. So what did you think about that one?
So that's another one that I watched on the last day because I had missed it. I'm not a big like horse movie person. And I was like, I don't know that I'm going to like this. Like, am I going to care? And I'm really glad I watched it. I don't think it was perfect. I think it was beautiful though. I mean, it's one of those movies where you can take so many stills and I would hang it up on my wall. It was just super pretty. And of course, acting was amazing. He did a great job because he won for it, right? Isn't that why he won? I think it was that, but,
yeah, he won.
I liked it a lot. I was surprised I liked it. Yeah. That's why I was able to watch it the last day. I was genuinely surprised that I enjoyed it. I didn't love it, but I liked the story and I like how it was, you know, he's an aging athlete and this is probably going to be his last year. He's clearly trying to power through. He's got all these injuries. So takes that like sports side of it. And then you've got the relationship with this person who shows up and says, I'm your son. So there's that whole aspect. And so it was so much more than just like, am I going to be watching a horse movie? It was so much more than that. And I'm glad I checked it out.
When I saw it on the schedule, it seemed like kind of a standard sports movie with maybe a little bit of an art twist. So I decided to skip it. But then when it won the acting award and I had time, I'm like, okay, I'm definitely going to watch this one. I agree with most of what you said, but I also want to add that it definitely plays up that art house vibe. And it kind of reminds me of like what Chloe Zhao has done with Nomadland, with The Rider, as well as like the works of Terrence Malick, where it's very lyrical in its direction and its cinematography. Its cinematography, honestly, I'd say it might be some of the best of the festival. Those sweeping landscapes were just beautiful. But another one that we've only seen is Together Together, which I personally, again, this is, I'd say, a pretty short one, but I personally found it to be a pleasing, charming, funny comedy up until the end, which it just like it ended a little bit too early for me, too abruptly, I'd say. And it just felt very, very inconclusive.
You're exactly right. It's another one that I was surprised. I mean, I love Ed Helms, and I said, this is going to be funny and cute and probably predictable, which it is exactly what it is. But it was, again, another ending that I was like, oh. And then I thought when the credits started, oh, it'll be one of those ones where like they start the credits and then they show you like another scene of the future or whatever. And they didn't. And I was, oh, that's the end. So it almost made me frustrated that I watched this whole movie and then it ended like that. The thing I do love about it is it does bring up, you know, platonic love and that a guy and a girl can be friends and love each other as friends and they're not in love, which I was a big fan of because I feel like we don't see enough of that on the screen. But you're right, the ending, I'm still mad about it.
Yeah. And so that's pretty much the end of the films that we have all seen at the U.S. Dramatic Competition. But now just to move into the documentary competition, I believe I was pretty much the only one who dipped my toes into this portion of the fest. But I do know that Valerie and me both saw Summer of Soul. So Valerie, what did you think about Summer of Soul? Because I believe you watched it on the last day of the fest. So I'm kind of curious to hear your opinion on it.
I've lived in Harlem for 20 years and I live like five blocks. Like I can walk over to the park where they held it, where they held the Harlem Culture Festival. And I've never heard about the festival before, ever. Mount Morris Park is not as big anymore because there's more things in it, but I never knew that part of history existed. And I was so embarrassed after I watched it because I was like, I feel like I should have known that, but I didn't. And it was, you know, it was a film that had my attention from beginning to end. You know, you see whole performances, you get to see whole performances of people in their prime, like Stevie Wonder and Gladys Knight. And, you know, it was really an emotional watch. Like I didn't cry or anything, but it was good to see that togetherness, you know, that sort of unification of people coming together, you know, high time at the very end of, when, you know, most civil rights leaders have been assassinated. I don't know. I'm really surprised that it didn't get bought right after it premiered. I'm still shocked, even though I know Hulu and Fox or Searchlight, whatever, maybe, you know, came together and bought this film. I was pretty sure that Neon was going to pick it up, and they didn't, so I don't know. But it was something I really enjoyed and really glad that I saw.
Yeah, so I actually had to miss this one in the opening night because of Coda. It overlapped a little bit, but I caught it at the last day. And while I'd say for me at least, it worked as a good like cultural chronicle, and it was like a very good like I'd say like life in a day documentary. But for what it was trying to be, I'd say it was a very good, powerful film. And I'm glad it also got distribution because when it finds its audience, it's going to be a hit for sure. And then, so just to list off a couple of other documentaries that I saw, which I don't believe anyone else has seen, is Users, which was a very slow pace, but like very, again, another Terrence Malick kind of film, just very transcendent. It sucks you in from start to finish. It's very abstract, so it's not going to be for everyone, but I personally really loved it. Another one that I saw was Homeroom, which was, it's kind of like the chronicle about this school where they're kind of dealing with, like, there's a lot of police kind of, like, dealing with their school and stuff, and they kind of, like, want to shift the funds to aspects of the education system, too, so they can get a better education. And I found it also to be, ended up accidentally kind of, like, being a chronicle also of the coronavirus crisis and how it kind of affected high school students. Because, again, it started filming, I believe, in September 2019, and then, again, by the end of it, everyone's in masks, everyone's social distance. So it kind of works on that level as well, which I found really intriguing. And the other one I saw was All Light Everywhere, which, again, another one. I like the documentaries in this section, honestly, because a lot of them took narrative risks that most documentaries wouldn't necessarily take. So that's something I appreciated. So, yeah, let's actually start with Flea, which ended up being one of the biggest titles of the festival. Got acquired by Neon, I believe, on less than 24 hours after its premiere. So, Valerie, why don't you start with that one? Because I know you mentioned it first.
Flea is about it's a refugee story about this guy who moved to Denmark. He actually didn't move there. He got refugee status in Denmark and had to leave his family behind in Russia, who were trying to escape the war that was happening in Kabul with the Taliban and stuff. And it's an animated documentary with true 2D animation. And from what I read, it was done that way to sort of keep the lead character's identity and stuff, you know, from being exposed, but it's a story. And it's a fully immersive experience when watching it. You feel like you're right there with this family that is just trying to escape war. And also he's gay, he's a homosexual. So that adds to the heightened level of danger. And despite being despite seemingly coming off as a tragedy, it's actually very hopeful and has a very good ending that won't leave you feeling empty and dirty and disgusted. So I really like the way that that unfolded and the way it's directed and stuff like that.
Yeah, I agree. I love this one. I thought the love story aspect of this was very touching and moving, and I thought the animation was incredible. Valerie, you said that it was primarily to mask the identity of the subject, but I think it just works so well. And this one had me from beginning to end, and it kind of reminded me of in 2008, A Waltz with Bashir, which was another animated documentary type film, which is also very, very good. And this was probably the best documentary of this festival. I just really, really enjoyed it.
I believe everyone who sees it will definitely enjoy it to some extent. It's a very personal and intimate story, but it does have very much a universal appeal because I feel like everyone in one way or another has felt like an outsider at some point in their lives. And this is a guy who is an outsider of multiple, like in multiple points, like his sexuality, his nationality, all that stuff. So I feel like it will work as a universal story. And it is interesting because it mixes like animation with documentary, but also it does have some live action shots, which is kind of cool to see. Like it's, again, these Sundance documentaries, a lot of them do not conform to the regular styles of documentaries. So that is something I really appreciate. But honestly, it's a very heartbreaking tale of this refugee, as Valerie was saying. And again, I feel like its universal themes will really connect with everyone. And the way the craftsmanship, the way it was put together was brilliant as well. So then the other one, which actually we all saw, and it also got acquired by Netflix, which was the first big Netflix acquisition of the fest, is that of Misha and the Wolves. So again, I believe that this is going to be a huge summer hit, that this is going to be a film that people are going to be tweeting about for at least a couple of weeks. But I want to hear what you guys thought about this one.
It reminded me a lot of, well, I won't say it reminded me a lot of Tiger King, but the way that the events unfold are sort of sensationalized. And I couldn't believe it. I didn't see that twist coming. And I really liked that that twist came pretty much at the beginning of the second act of the documentary. And it was like, okay, so now that we know this, how are we going to deal with it? And I like that the film spent the time to deal with what the aftermath was of that twist. And it really left me saying, like, girl, why didn't you do this? I was like, this is interesting. And I really highly enjoyed Misha and the Wolves. I saw it toward the end of the fest. And I couldn't look away.
It's funny you say the Tiger King thing, because I messaged one of my friends and I said, you know how we loved Tiger King? You're going to love this one because it's kind of like Tiger King. And then she's like, what's it called? I'm like, Misha and the Wolves. And she's like, does someone own wolves? Is this? And I'm like, no, because it's not like that kind of Tiger King. But it's that these twists are things you would never have imagined that this happened. And I didn't know this story ahead of time. And after watching it, I started to tell my husband about it. And he's like, oh, I know that story. I know the book and I know what happened. And I'm like, really? I had no clue. But I think this is something that people who know the story will enjoy and people who don't know it will enjoy just because it's so crazy. And you're right. I'm glad they took the time to deal with it and they didn't just end it like, and here's the twist, the end. They give you a lot of time to process it and see what happened following those events.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add. I think you guys both covered everything I wanted to say with this, but I'm not surprised at all that Netflix snatched this one up. It's very their brand of documentary, like the sensationalist, grab you with the twists type documentary, and I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah, again, I pretty much agree with everything you guys said, and just to reiterate my first point, for those of you who are listening, this, I'm sure, whenever it's out, is going to take over Twitter, and it's going to be hilarious and insane to see it play out, and I can't wait. Because honestly, I feel you guys mentioned Tiger King, but I also feel it's very reminiscent of Firefest, where it was this kind of like unbelievable premise. People saw it and they were like, whoa, it's actually real. And then they start diving deeper. And then like you see things start kind of moving and you kind of see pieces moving in the distance. And then you start getting closer and closer until it just all collapses. And then it comes back to the beginning. And just the way it's structured, again, it seems very, very much for the Netflix base. And I believe everyone is going to absolutely love it. So that's pretty much it from our world documentary coverage. And now just to go back up to the world dramatic. Again, me and Tessa were pretty much the only ones who kind of covered this section. But I believe you watched The Dog Who Wouldn't Be Quiet, which I actually screened last night. So I'm also curious to hear what you thought about that one.
Yeah, this one, I wasn't going to watch it. And one of my friends said, just watch it. And it just is, I can see why people would like it. It just was not for me. It jumped around too much. And I didn't like how they're like, this is going on. Now it's this completely different story, sort of, but it's the same guy. And now it's this completely different story, sort of, but it's the same guy. And it was too all over the place for me that I couldn't enjoy it. I felt like by the time I got into a story, it changed to a different story, even though it was the same main character and was too all over the place for me. But I can see how some people would enjoy it.
Yeah, same here. I mean, honestly, it wasn't going to be on my list, but then I read a couple of reviews and then a couple of friends were like, this seems like something you'd like. In terms of, again, I don't think it's a spoiler because it was literally in the synopsis, but there's like a part with like an asteroid and it's like this kind of like surrealist people like wearing bubbles in this like new society. And I read that and I was like, okay, this sounds like something I'd love. To my dismay, it ended up being the 10 minutes after the third act climax. Out of like about a 70-minute film, 10 minutes was from what I was actually promised. So I don't know if it was a case of maybe like me just not having the right expectations, but it really fell flat for me. I was very disappointed in it. But those 10 minutes, I will say those 10 minutes were great. They were very surreal, but I honestly would have enjoyed seeing that world expanded into a full film. That's something I would have watched, but for what it was, I would not really recommend it to anyone except for maybe people who are looking to get into more international cinema. But some other ones that we saw, you saw Human Factors as well, which again, I mean, let's just hear what you got to say because I have some thoughts on that one.
Well, I bailed on that one. So I watched it for an hour and I looked at the clock and I went, nothing has happened in an hour except there's this rat that's about all I've figured out. And I want to be able to watch a different movie. So I bailed on it after an hour and I never once thought about, gee, I wonder how that ended. It doesn't bother me at all. I just didn't really, I felt like nothing happened in the first hour and I just didn't care.
I definitely agree. This was a film that, I mean, again, this was another one where I saw the synopsis and I was like, ooh, like Home Invasion. This sounds like it could be very good. And once again, Home Invasion was, they didn't even show the Home Invasion. And I was just like, it's more like about people's reactions to the Home Invasion. And it circles back to that moment again and again and again. But it gets so redundant to the point where when it's actually finally revealed kind of like what happened, it is so, I'm telling you, I mean, I don't think I'm going to spoil it on here, but I'll tell you afterwards, it is so underwhelming. Like, you'll think I'm joking when I tell you how it ends, because from a thematic sense, it works, but like from a narrative sense, it's terrible. Like, it just an incredible letdown. So some other films that I watched in the world dramatic were Primetime, which is a very tense thriller, the story is pretty shallow, but the way it's edited, the way it's kind of put together, it's very intriguing. I believe it's by the director of Corpus Christi. So I'd say potentially like Dunkirk meets the King of Comedy. I guess those are both like very high regarded films, maybe a little bit lower than that with a more simplistic story, I'd say. That's worth a watch. And then the other one was Fire in the Mountains, which honestly, I was a little bit perplexed by it. It's a story about kind of like in this like Indian community about like, okay, like science versus religion and like healing this disabled kid who's on a wheelchair. But it's kind of confusing because again, I'm not going to spoil anything, but there's things that happen where you're not even sure what's dream and what's reality. And I've seen some reviews address that as, oh, this is a dream and this is like just reality, or like him faking something. And again, it could be a little bit clearer, but there's some transcendent filmmaking in there, which I'm sure many will enjoy. But anyways, now moving on to the midnight section. Again, this was a section that was actually my first time I had a midnight section and I really, really enjoyed it. So I just want to start with A Glitch in the Matrix, which Jeffrey and I saw. So I know it's been getting some high praise, but some pretty critical reviews as well. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that one too.
Yeah, I did not like A Glitch in the Matrix, I'm sorry to say. I think if you've seen Rodney Asher's The Shining documentary, Room 237, which I think a lot of people loved. It was a really high Rotten Tomato score, which I didn't really enjoy that much either, but that was, I think A Glitch in the Matrix takes everything that's annoying and grating about Room 237 and amplifies it and cranks it up to 11. I think there's a lot of like navel-gazing conspiracy theories. I think he just lets these kind of crackpots loose and just talk about these conspiracy theories throughout like the whole documentary. I think it works better for like a 2.5 hour horror movie like The Shining. I think that works better. But in regards to something like Simulation Theory, which has such a storied history that goes to like Philip K. Dick and even before the advent of computers, like it goes all the way back to Plato, you know, and to waste it on all this navel gazing is really surface level to me and it could have been a lot better, I think. I did not enjoy this one.
So yeah, I went into this actually not having seen Room 237. So that was, again, I really didn't know what to think about that. But I do have to agree, from a filmmaking point of view, the visuals were insane. Very inspired, I'd say, for a documentary. I'd say it really transcends the medium where you don't feel like you're watching a documentary. But that is partially because I'd say near the halfway point, it goes from more informative parts to more anecdotes from random people and their experience with the simulation theory, which, again, if that was the film, the point of the film, then, like, so be it. But it should have focused on that. But it should not have been, oh, a documentary, like an informative documentary, and then just end with a bunch of anecdotes to very specific people. Some of them which were frankly, well, some of them which were haunting, some of them which were frankly ridiculous. So I was left not knowing really what to think about that one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I just wanted to agree with you because... I think there's definitely something fascinating to say about people who wholeheartedly believe in the simulation theory and that we're all living in a simulation. It's fascinating to do a documentary like focused on people who believe that and how it affects their lives. He didn't really do that with this documentary, and he didn't really talk about like the history of the theory and like science and not science behind it. And you could have gone in either direction and it would have been fine, but he didn't. And he focused on a lot about on these like whacked out conspiracy theorists. And I just couldn't connect with that. So
another midnight film that I believe all three of us have watched is that of Coming Home in the Dark, which I really enjoyed. But Tessa, what did you think about that one?
I loved this movie so much. I was hooked like right from the beginning. And I'm like, oh, this is what's gonna happen. Oh, now this is gonna happen. Oh, now this is gonna happen. And parts of it were, once you started to get the story, it was a little bit predictable where it was going, more or less. But I still thought it was like crazy enjoyable. There were moments where I was jumping out of my skin. I watched it at night, so I was like, even like huddling, like I was a little nervous, like in my office alone, the whole rest of the house is asleep. I'm like, are these people gonna come in here and accuse me of doing something a long time ago and they're gonna come? I don't know. It was just crazy. It did a really good job of getting in my head right from the start, and I started trying to piece together theories, and as things came out, I really loved it. I thought it was great. It was good at keeping me on my toes, and while it did get a little predictable towards the end, it was still really definitely worth watching. I'm really glad I checked this one out.
But I'm actually, this is the one I regret not seeing, because I'm that sort of thriller is like 100% my jam, but my schedule was just too packed. I'll have to check it out some other way.
Yeah, yeah.
Check it out again, for sure. You have to.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because it was, I'd say also it's very derivative of Funny Games, honestly. Like, this is a modern Funny Games, and I'll tell you, like, it delivered. It was a little predictable for what it was trying to go for. I think it did very well in kind of subverting some expectations while kind of keeping that sense of horror and dread. And then another one that we both saw was that of Censor. So again, Jeffrey, what did you think about that one?
I think Censor was probably my favorite horror film from this year's Sundance. Pretty stripped down, not some crazy plot here, but I thought it was a loving tribute to video nasties, you know, like the 80s in London and in England with the gore and the violence and the sex and things like that that they tried really hard to censor back then. And I thought it was a loving tribute to that. It had like the film grain and the color grading of that. And it has something really interesting to say about the value of difficult and ugly art. And I think digestible horror here. I really liked it. It's probably the horror movie I had the best time watching.
Yeah, honestly. So this was, I believe, the first midnight screening, which I attended live. And same, the first, same. I'd say like, we're very much grounded in that kind of like her work. Cause she, like the main character is like, works as like a film censor, and her watching that work, all while like the lingering memory of her, like her missing sister is there, who like was presumed dead, but like she's not quite sure. But, and I also, again, we're not going to go into spoilers, but it does end up transitioning into a more like, she starts feeling like that she's in these films, that she's participating in these films, to the point where the director, I think it's her feature debut, incredible job. That last third act, switching like aspect ratios, switching, like it's not like just as a gimmick, like they actually have a meaning as to like why it's switching. And it goes from a more passive story where it's just like intriguing to like a visceral, like in your face retelling of kind of just like what the themes she's explored in the first to acts of the film. And the ending as well, this was like, again, this was the first ambiguous ending, I'd say, of the festival. And I know it didn't sit right with a lot of people, but it also weirdly reminded me of, have you guys seen like unedited footage of a bear or like any of those kind of like creepy Adult Swim shorts?
Yeah, it's like the surreal shorts.
Yeah, it reminded me very much of that. Those surreal shorts where you're like, it seems good, but there's like, then there's like little glitches where you're like, oh shit, like this is not what we thought it was. That was a great use of an ambiguous ending because it gives you just enough like breadcrumbs to know that there's some substance there, but it still has you trying to figure it out. And I'm still trying to, like, in my mind, I'm still trying to piece it together, but I know for a fact that there is some substance there from the breadcrumbs that were left.
Right. Cause like the glitches and stuff, I don't want to get into spoilers, like you said, but like,
yeah,
it's more than just cosmetic and more than just like cool effects. Yeah. It actually plays into the film's message. And I love that. It was great.
Basically just like censors the, I took it as kind of like, it just censors her reality, which again, mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to spoilers, but I appreciated how it kind of like used its visual tricks to relate back to its themes. So that kind of concludes our Midnight section coverage. So now I wanted to go to what I think may have been one of my favorite sections of the fest, which was that of the next section. Which I know, I believe Jeffrey's just saw one of those films, so we're going to start with that one, which is We're All Going to the World's Fair. But then the rest, me and Tessa pretty much did have some extensive coverage on that. So again, Jeffrey, why don't you start us off with We're All Going to the World's Fair?
We're All Going to the World's Fair. I thought I missed something here. I think everyone's raving about this film. I just don't get it. I understand the creepy atmosphere. I think the lead performance is great, but I'm just lacking all the substance here or the context necessary to process this in the right way. I just thought it was really kind of boring, I'm sorry to say. I mean, I'm hoping you guys can like shed some light and maybe even correct me, because everyone's raving about this and I wanna like it. I wanna love it. And like I think this creepypasta stuff is like right up my alley, but I just was not feeling this one at all. I don't know what you guys thought.
This one terrified me. Like, I'm not gonna lie.
Really?
I won't even say the name of I'm like, I feel like I said it too many times, and aren't you like, if you say it three times, it's gonna happen. Like, I'm not gonna say anything anymore. I don't know. I think, again, it's when I watched late at night when I watched it. Everyone else in the house is asleep. I had all the lights up, and I think that ambiance definitely helped. I had like it just on my computer screen. I didn't even have it on the TV, so I was like in my office kind of freaking out about it. I don't like, there was one part that really stuck with me is the guy is playing back a video of hers, and it's on this one pause of her face. Felt like way too long. It was like 15 minutes. I'm like, I don't want to see this creepy face. There were parts where I literally had to look away. That stuff always creeps me out though. I get so into the, is this real? Is it not? I know it's not real, but like, then my brain kind of goes, but is it real? Like, is this happening? So that stuff has always freaked me out to the point where it drives my husband crazy, because he'll be like, you are so ridiculous. You are a child. But even the part where they're like pulling tickets out of the... Oh,
yeah, I remember that.
Oh, yeah, that was...
No, I was like, I can't watch this. There were so many moments I had to look away. And I think that's what got me. The end, I wasn't a giant fan of the end. I kind of wish they had left it more ambiguous a little bit. I mean, I guess they kind of tried to throw it in a little, but I don't know. It just terrified me. But that stuff always scares me. So, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, Diego? I mean, honestly, I feel like it could be best described as like Creepypasta the movie. Because again, it doesn't ever go into like that terrifying territory, but it does kind of just like things that just creep up in the back of your mind. Like Tessa was saying, you start thinking about it, and you're kind of left with like, just what is going on? The thing is, again, I actually thought that the ending was a little bit too ambiguous, because I feel like they were trying to make the relationship between the main character and a strange man. Like, they were trying to make like what their relationship was. Some people thought like, okay, he was definitely like on the pedophile side. Other people thought like, oh, like he's just someone who's like worried about the game. I honestly wasn't even quite sure if it ended up with the, like, what I took from it was that the game, for a role play game or whatever, I'm forgetting, I think, what it's called, just like one of those like virtual role play games where like everyone's in on it. That's what I took from it. Like, that's what I thought ended, like, it ended with. But so again, I think I found the ending to be a little too ambiguous, which is kind of strange, because like, you thought it was a little too unambiguous. But again, very, very creepy film. Probably is the best one that maintains like that perfect level of like creepy but not terrifying, but like it's still intriguing you.
I just felt like My thing about it, though, is I feel like we didn't need that guy in there really at all. I think it could have just focused on her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I feel like that was maybe like just a way to like kind of bring the audience into it. But I honestly don't know. Again, like just the whole the inclusion of that guy, especially in the ending. Again, I wouldn't say threw things off. Maybe question a little bit more of like what I thought about the entire film. But one thing's for sure, this, I guess, is one of the best or worst, depending on your view of horror, films to watch on a laptop. Because I also watched it like on my laptop, and there's definitely some screens where like it takes you into the laptop screen. And scenes like that, those were quite the experience to watch on a screen like that. So yeah, those were my thoughts on We're All Going to the World's Fair.
I'm going to have to give it another shot because I'm a big horror nut, and I don't know. This one didn't quite work for me, but I'm willing to watch it again. So I'm curious.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I'm sure like it'll get some like indie, like some buzzy indie distributor mm-hmm. sooner or later, because it really feels up that alley of the film Twitter will rave about it for sure. Going into the rest of the festival, I know that Son of Monarchs, that was one that I saw that it was very personal to me. And I believe it was in that section more for how it explored science. But it's basically just about this like Latinx immigrant who travels to New York to kind of like start his career as a biologist, but then he leaves his family behind, and that creates some tension and some conflict. Some people found it to be a little bit too slow, and I did find the pace to be a little bit grating at some points, but overall it's very much a great use of like metaphors, because it's called Son of Monarchs. It uses the monarch as a metaphor for both the structure, his character arc. It's a very smart, I think Alexis Gambis is the director's name, he's a very smart guy in terms of using metaphors to create a concrete narrative. But another one I believe me and Tessa saw was Strawberry Mansion, which I found it to be a pretty surreal Lynchian odyssey. I found it to be like as if David Lynch directed Inception. That's what I took from it.
That's like a super good way to describe that. I thought it was a lot of fun. I saw a lot of people complaining about like the end, but I kind of dug the end, and I found it was interesting that everything tied back together. You know what I mean? I tried not giving spoilers, but as you're going through, and then when you get to like the second half, you're like, oh wait, that connects with that, and that connects with that. And it was a very interesting concept, and it was really great, like sets, like fantastic sets, and the cinematography. I really liked it. I felt like it was one that I thought would be a hit or miss with me, just from the description and the picture. I was like, oh, is this gonna be good mm-hmm. or bad? And I within 20 minutes was like, oh, I'm gonna love this movie. It's so bizarre, but I really loved it. I really, really liked the ending and the way it all tied together.
There were some parts that I did not really follow, but I think that was the intention of the film, because I think the whole point was kind of like make you feel as if you are in a dream as you watch the film. Like it very much has that dream logic, even though it didn't have really like a solid plot. Just the atmosphere it captured was, once again, like I think David Lynch directing Inception, especially with that final sequence where like everything starts collapsing in on itself. It was one of my favorite films of the festival, and one of the most acute directions of the festival. So then another one that me and Tessa saw was The Blazing World. So I know this one was a little bit controversial, actually. I believe it was the lowest rated film of the entire festival on Letterboxd, even though I know it has some passionate fans. So
I was mixed on this one. It was one I was really looking forward to from the beginning. I thought, well, this is going to be a good one. I'm very intrigued. And I think there are moments where it's clearly inspired by like Alice in Wonderland, Pan's Labyrinth. And it's just sometimes it's a little too inspired by it, which I think if you've seen it, you'll know what I mean. But it's gorgeous. The whole thing is gorgeous to watch. There's some incredible scenes where you're just like, what is happening? The story is not great, but the end I really liked. And I think she gave a powerful performance there. And didn't she direct also? And I think maybe she bit off a little more than she could chew with that. And that's maybe where it fell flat a little. However, I still think it was fun. I mean, I don't think it was bad by any means. It didn't reach my expectations, but I had like insanely high expectations for it just from description and pictures. And I think that's the problem where it feels like it fell flat for me. I loved it. I mean, I didn't love it. I really liked it, but I don't know. It didn't hit my expectations, but I still enjoyed it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, honestly, I feel like it's kind of funny to see how much we're on the same page for a lot of these. But again, this was probably my most anticipated film of the fest. I really, again, I had insanely high expectations that it didn't quite meet. But still, like, for what it was, like, in one word, I would say it would be ambitious. Because, again, this is Carlson Young I believe she directed, she wrote, she acted in this, and she actually directed, wrote, and acted, and produced, I believe, the short. So I think if there's one big takeaway from this film is that Carlson Young is definitely going to be like a powerful voice in independent filmmaking for years to come. Because I feel like once she kind of reins in that ambition and is able to focus it more, she's going to be like a great voice in independent filmmaking. Because again, for a feature film debut, and I think this is her second project, because her first one was a short, and now she's doing the feature film. Just for these ideas and how she was able to kind of like transmit it to the screen, while not perfect, do show a lot of promise for her. So Crypto Zoo, it was the wildest film of the entire festival. It was like just tripping on acid. It just took all the drugs in the world, put them into Indiana Jones, and it's just like, it's just this insane gore fest that just like no logic whatsoever, but I absolutely loved it. So what did you think about this one?
That's kind of how I felt. So I will say I feel duped, because I went into this one like, I love Michael Cera, and then he's in it for like 5 seconds. So I was kind of annoyed about that. But in the beginning, honestly, I started it and I was like, okay, this is a little awkward. I felt a little awkward watching some of the animated physical. I was like, okay, yeah, well, they're really technically getting everything. They're doing a good job with the animation, but like, this is maybe a little too much. And then after the first, 10 minutes, I was like, oh, okay. Oh, and then I got so into it. And the story was, I'm still not 100% sure maybe what exactly happened, but I loved the story. And I felt like it was very much like a, acceptance, right? I feel like in the low level, there's like a, just accept things, even if people aren't, you know, everybody's different. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like there's actually a decent message in there somewhere, even though it's so crazy. And the last half hour was just insane. So I don't even want to talk about it because I don't want to ruin it for people. But I was so...
Yeah.
It ended and I was like, I think I kind of loved this movie. And I did not think I was going to love it when it first started.
Because it swings through the fences and it somehow makes it, which, I think there's actually a great way to kind of go into talking about the premieres, which is another film that kind of just went batshit crazy, which unfortunately didn't really work for me. I don't know about you, but Prisoners of the Ghostland, I think Sonos, English language debut with Nicolas Cage. So what did you think?
So for me, I absolutely loved this movie because I'm taking it for exactly what it is, which is a crazy movie. You can't go into this looking for something serious. You can't go into it thinking, well, this is just going to be a game changer and an award winner, because it's not. It's literally insane Nicolas Cage being even insaner Nicolas Cage somehow. There's a story there somewhere. I don't even care about it, to be perfectly honest with you. I was there for the crazy Western samurai, like post-apocalyptic Mad Max, Nicolas Cage having body parts explode type of movie. I mean, I told my friend, I said, if you ever want to hear Nicolas Cage scream testicle at the top of his lungs, like, I have the movie for you. And it actually works when he does it. I don't know. If you take it as a not serious, this is just a bizarre, insane, trippy movie, then I mean, that's what it is. So that's what you got to take it for, I think.
I mean, the thing that I think it didn't work for me was that, okay, Crypto Zoo, like, it's insanity, but it feels like it has a purpose. It feels like it has some sort of artistic merit, at least, because the animation was, like, incredible. But with this one, I felt like it was really, like, instead of, like, Sona or, like, Cage going up to Sona's level of insanity, like, because, again, I believe Sona, like, is more like insanity with purpose and with artistry, but I feel like this was very much insanity without purpose and without artistry. Like, again, there were some sets and there was some beautiful production design here and there in the eastern side of the world. In the opening bank robbery sequence, like, the color grading there was amazing. It really popped, but for the most of it, especially Mad Max style, like, lands, it looked atrocious just from a visual standpoint, and just that's honestly what really didn't do it for me. And it felt more like a direct video Nicolas Cage knockoff film than an actual work of Sona. So that's a little bit why it disappointed me. But I do admit that, like, if you go in with that mindset of, like, just want the most insane time, no logic whatsoever, this is definitely, I'd say, the live action counterpart to Crypto Zoo at Sundance. For sure. So anyways, other premieres. I mean, this was a pretty impressive section. I mean, in the same breath, very good COVID documentary. I think it focused a little bit too much on like specific responses rather than like kind of the more global response that I thought it was going to take from its synopsis. But it was kind of like a good way to counter all the joyfulness of CODA. So I guess it worked to even things out. How it ends, that's one that I saw that I don't believe you did. That's another one that actually works as a very like well-made pocket of joy, but it's very much a vanity project with a lot of celebrity cameos. If it comes at the right moment when we're all just kind of like a little bit down, a little bit still in quarantine, a little bit kind of just dealing with things, I feel like it could definitely find its audience because it's very, very joyful and it distracts. Despite the fact that it was filmed during the pandemic, it very much is able to distract you from kind of like all the, because even though it like deals with like, okay, an asteroid's coming to Earth and the world is basically ending. So people are just like having fun, having their time of their lives, just enjoying outside the fresh air for one last night. And it's a very fun, joyful film that if you're in the mood for it, it will definitely work for you. But again, if you're looking kind of like what you said with Prisoners of Ghostland, if you're looking for a serious award-winning film, you'll just find a vanity project with too many cameos that you won't like. And now let's move on to some of the films that we've actually, well, both seen, I think, in the Earth. Now, hearing your taste and kind of how it's developed, I'm very, very curious to hear what you think about this one. So go ahead, I guess.
So in the Earth, I was like, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe this. So I am a giant fan of gore for some reason. I don't know why. I don't know where that comes from. Like, I enjoy when I have to look away from a screen. And I feel like I got that quite a bit in the Earth, especially towards the end when someone literally has a thing hanging off their face for so long and they're just zooming in on his face and he's talking and he's gonna, But that being said, the movie itself, I felt like it took a little while to get where I wanted it to go. The beginning first half hour, I just speed it up. Let's go. I don't really care about the background stuff with a movie like this. Just me personally. I know where it's going to end up and I want to get to the good stuff. But I think it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it, especially the second half towards the end. I thought it was fun and interesting, and I liked the gore. And I mean, it reminds me of a, like, you know, survival, run away and try to survive while you're out being hunted by a murderer, basically. There's a little bit of a twist in there, which I saw coming, still felt like it delivered at the end, even though I figured that's where it was going to go. But I enjoyed it. It's got a good amount of gore. I think it also kind of touches on isolation, which is stuff we're all dealing with right now, and kind of how being stuck alone or with not so many people for so long can kind of mess with you. So that's what I thought. I think it was a little too much into the whole myth. But other than that, I liked it.
Yeah, because I mean, I touched on this aspect a little bit on Cinemania World, where I had a full discussion on it with Dwayne Miller. So go check that out if you haven't yet. What I really liked about this one is, well, one of the many things that I liked about this one, because honestly, this was probably my favorite of the entire festival, was that I think it's the first great pandemic film, because all these pandemic films like Lockdown, like Songbird, they really take the pandemic in stride and just bring it into their story and do a very, very bad job of kind of like incorporating it into their story. But this is a film that takes the themes of the pandemic and uses it as a backdrop for its story. So it's not like the pandemic's at the forefront of your mind. It's not like the pandemic had a direct influence on any of the events. But the fact that the pandemic, you know that there's a pandemic that happened in the backdrop of the story, does accentuate some of its themes of, as you said, isolation, of them, like, where they have nowhere to go to. I mean, it partially kind of works because, like, they're in the woods, no Wi-Fi, no cellular data. I'd say the only thing that I'd say held this back from being a great 10 out of 10 for me was, apart from the fact that, yeah, the beginning, it did go on a little bit too long, is the fact that the editing, like, Ben Wheatley edits it as if it's, like, a 2000s music video, which, again, there's some sequences at the end where, because at the beginning, okay, it doesn't work at all for like the first hour or the first hour and a half. It just does not work at all. And it feels super out of place, super disorienting in a bad way. But the place where it truly does work is, again, we're not going to spoil anything, but in a final sequence that I'd really say it's reminiscent of potentially like 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Lighthouse, in terms of that kind of surreal vibe where you just have no idea what's going on, but it's just like your senses are being assaulted. And also, that's another thing, the sound design, absolutely amazing. I mean, this is me, midnight TV turned all the way up, and like, that was those were some insane sounds. And the strobe light, they use strobe lights as well. That's another thing. The cinematography, the use of lighting specifically, it was very creative. I feel like Ben Wheatley, as of late, he's been making bigger and bigger films that like have been kind of sapping away his creativity. But he was forced here with the pandemic to strip down, to kind of go back to basics, to just create something out of creativity's sake. And this is just, I think the pandemic forced this moment of creativity. He wrote it in a span of 15 days, filmed it, I think, in another 15 days. And you can really see that Ben Wheatley, he works at his best. And when he's forced to just buckle down and go under pressure, the most low budget things possible while still, under pressure, while still tackling some great, great themes. Another one that we saw that, well, pretty much everyone was absolutely raving about was that of Mass. So I kind of want to hear your thoughts on that as well.
Oh my gosh. I loved this movie so much. You're basically four actors carrying in one room, more or less. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a couple other actors that come in at the beginning and the end, and you see like the outside of that room, but that's it. You're really four characters in a room for the entire thing. And the entire thing is heart-wrenching. It's heartbreaking. It's so emotional. I mean, it's dealing with mass shootings. School shootings, which unfortunately is a big problem. And they touch on gun violence and they touch on, you know, this can't be in vain. We need to have better gun laws, which as a parent is really important to me because I mean, I hate that my kids go to school and they come home and they're like, oh, we had a lockdown drill today. We have to hide somewhere and be quiet. That's scary. That's terrifying that my kid has to do that stuff. I didn't have to do that stuff. Why does my kid, I'm not that old. So why does my kid have to do that stuff? When she's 4 years old, she comes home from school. I had to hide in a closet and find a place to be quiet. So as a mom, I felt like I went on the journey with both sets of parents. Like, what would you do if you were in this situation or if you were in this situation? And I think they're both impossible situations and heartbreaking situations. And it's also such a power of forgiveness, I think. I mean, within probably 30 minutes, I was a sobbing mess all the way through the end of the movie. I connected with Martha Plimpton probably the most, and Ann Dowd really, and that's probably just being a mom. But I think all four of them were incredible with all their emotions, right? I'm angry. I'm angry at you. I'm angry at this person. I'm upset at this. And when they start telling their stories to each other, I can't even talk about it. I'll start crying. It was so powerful.
This was a film that I actually didn't even have reserved as a premiere because I saw the description. It seemed all right. I was like, oh, maybe I'll catch it if it gets good reviews. And then I was lucky enough to get a primetime early screener. So then I watched that a couple days before the premiere. And then so I was like, okay, well, the only film that I'm interested in from this section is Mass. I put it on and I am so glad that I got to go to the premiere because honestly, again, I'd say it's my second favorite film of the festival, but it's for sure going to be the one that I think is going to be the most praised with the biggest Oscar chances later down the road because there's very, very few films that have made me cry. And Mass is one of them because it's just, again, those parts where they start telling their stories, it's just incredible. It's actually the only film that I saw twice at the festival because I saw it once myself. And another time I'm like, you know what? Second screening, family, come on over. We got to watch this because it's the best film. I think the one that's going to resonate the most with people outside of the festival, or maybe not necessarily film people, but just like everyone in general. It touches it in such a timely way where, again, like films like this, you'd expect it to be like, oh, from the side of the shooter's parents, like, oh, very conservative, like, oh, the shooter had his rights, or oh, from the side of the victim's parents and all about just like just fighting for what is right and all that stuff. But what this does is that it's able to meet at both ways and you can kind of see everyone's perspectives. And it's not like I wouldn't say I found any of it to be controversial. Like they all have their points and they made them very well. And you just feel bad for everyone involved in the situation because it touches on their faults, their strengths as parents, the faults of the education system, the faults of the government, whether it's good to bring in a mental health professional, whether it's good to bring in the police, like what's the best thing to do? Just all these topics that I feel like, well, obviously because of the pandemic, one of the good things is that there hasn't been a situation like this in recent, but before this, like it was, I mean, America had a problem with all this stuff because it was just week after week. And this film, it blew me away. The performance is amazing. And the thing is, something that I think has gone pretty unmentioned in like most reviews or coverage that I've seen is Fran Kranz's debut direction. He could have very much framed this in a very conventional way and just let the actors take the stage. And again, not to single out any films, but there have been some based on a play films that are in Oscar race where I feel like it does very much just set the cameras down and let the actors do their thing. And it works, but it's like, it could have been a little bit better. Not this film. He starts out, this is another film that changes aspect ratios with meaning. Also, like, he starts out very stable, right? And then as their emotional state deteriorates and deteriorates and deteriorates, it gets up closer, it gets more visceral, it gets much more shakier. The aspect ratio even begins to change. And it actually does have some ambiguous parts to it, which I like as well, like the meaning of the orange ribbon. I honestly didn't quite get what it signified, but it was for sure something that was prominent in the beginning, middle, and end of the film. And I think even Fran Kranz in the Q&A, because that was actually, I think, one of the only two Q&As that I saw in the entire festival at the second screening. He said that he actually, he preferred to not share what that meant because he wanted that to be kind of like up to interpretation, which I find that to be a pretty bold and nice move, because honestly, this is a film that it just blew me away.
Yeah, it's just incredible. It's heartbreaking and it's hard to watch, but I think it's one that is important to watch because when you get to the end, it makes it worth it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, yeah. And I've had multiple people tell me like, oh, saw you went to Sundance. Do you have any recommendations for when films come out later stuff? And the one I tell everyone is, next time Mass plays out at a festival, it's $10 to $15. Go watch it, because I'm telling you, this is going to last. If this gets the right distributor, which is like I say, Netflix or Searchlight or Focus, this is going to make a push for awards. It could get the ensemble. It could honestly, depending on what's going on in our world in 2022, I could very well see it getting nominated and being a front runner for Best Picture. Yeah. It's very grounded. It's very small, but we've seen in the past small films that are grounded, if their performances are good, they can go all the way. But yeah, this film, I mean, honestly, the only reason it's not my favorite is because I just have a really soft spot for experimental horror. So that's why I In the Earth is a little bit higher up. But just from a pure dramatic standpoint, this is by far the best film of the festival.
Oh yeah, my favorite by far too. I mean, it's just so good, and it's just like you and people say, have you seen any good ones? Mass, you have to watch Mass. Just make sure, keep an eye out, put Google alerts, whatever you have to do, make sure you see this movie.
And fantastic. Just overall, just looking at the festival, I mean, I do want to hear your overall impressions, both of the quality of the films and your festival experience. But for me, at least, this was very much a festival where there were a lot of films that I absolutely loved, but that this is, there, again, it's Sundance. There's going to be a lot of divisive films. Most of the time, I ended up loving them. There were a couple that I hated, but this was very much, I think, a festival that, in terms of quality, really worked for me, but I know it did not work for everyone. But yeah, I'd say Mass was one of the few ones that just really popped out for, I'd say, pretty much everyone who saw it. Again, there's films like Land, like Judas, The World to Come, that actually premiered at this festival, and Night of Kings as well, or not necessarily premiered, but had a spotlight screening, and we'll be actually discussing those on future podcast episodes, because most of them are actually coming out in the next couple of weeks or two, so we're just going to save them for those in-depth discussions down the road. But just overall, the quality was amazing. And another thing is, again, I've been to TIFF, New York, AFI, and now Sundance in terms of virtual festivals. No offense to New York Film Festival, because they were still very much the first trial runs. They were figuring it out. But I feel that Sundance really captured that festival experience, that rush of putting on a film and staying up and just watching back to back to back to back. And then going on Twitter, seeing all the buzz, talking to your friends. And I think, honestly, this was one of the best, the best virtual festival experience I've personally had.
Yeah, so this was my first, not only virtual festival experience, this is my first festival experience. I had never done this before. It was something I never applied to do because I always thought, I don't have time to sit and watch 100 movies in a weekend. Mm-hmm. What am I thinking? Again, as a mom, right? My kids are young. Mm-hmm. But now they're home. It's not like I have to leave to go take them to school. They're doing virtual schooling, so we're all home, which I was a little nervous about the Wi-Fi connection being how are three of us going to be on the computer constantly? And it ended up working out really well. I was sitting here, movie to movie to movie. Like you said, sometimes if there's two at the same time, I'd have my reserved one and I'd watch that and I'd be able to sneak into the next one. I had many a stay up till 2 a.m. nights. And then I'm going to try to write about this movie now. And my brain is mush because I watched 30 movies. This is crazy. But I loved it. I really enjoyed it. And it made me think of what an in-person festival would be, where you're going movie to movie to movie. I feel like almost the way this worked, because of what we were talking about, where you could sneak into the next premiere, you have option to see even more movies than you would in an in-person. Yeah. So I immediately was and I actually during this found out I got into South by Southwest, which I had applied for a while back. So I'm excited to do it again.
Yeah, I guess I'll see you there then, because, like, honestly, I've heard great things about that festival as well, in terms of how it deals with technology. There's definitely some, like, more technological sections to this. Well, I mean, there's a new frontier section, which we didn't cover on this one, but I got the VR headset. I went a little bit into the rooms, and it seems nice, so I can't wait to go to South By. But I am curious also to hear, how many films did you end up watching?
I watched 30 movies, and I watched the animation shorts, but I didn't get to watch any of the other shorts. But the animation shorts were good. I liked that. Did you watch that
one? Yeah, yeah. I mean, the short... I did not watch the animation shorts. I watched one of the live-action short programs, which, again, those were very good. But overall, I think I watched about 35 films.
Oh, man. Wow.
But yeah, it was really back-to-back. And I was lucky enough to get some of them as, like, early screeners. So, like, I was able to pace myself a little bit better. But still, it was great experience, and honestly, it's a great festival, and I cannot wait to hopefully go in person next year.
I know, me too. Well, I'll see you there, hopefully in person.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
That's it for this week's episode of the Global Film Podcast. Thank you to everyone for coming on board, and thank you all for listening. Make sure to rate, subscribe, and follow us to be notified when the next episode comes out. Next week, we will be going back to the regular format of the show with a critic roundtable to discuss Judas and the Black Messiah, Saint Maud, Malcolm and Marie, and Land.